Bob and look into it. So okay. This could be her lucky day the other day. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And after that, have you seen her again?
No, the next day I didn't see her. That was 2 days ago, and like Wednesday or Thursday, and I didn't see her on Friday. So so the question is, when I see her next, could be tomorrow or your Sunday, it could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, do I bug her about did she listen to it? Do I say, what's the etiquette there in normal terms? You know what I mean?
Right, or you would just wait for her to bring it up because...
Yeah, I wouldn't want to embarrass her because she probably
didn't
do it.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to embarrass her. Right.
Yeah, so it'll depend on the mood I'm in will determine what I'll do.
Uh-oh.
I won't care which way I present myself, so it'll just be up to whatever the mood is. And probably one way to do it would be to just say hi to her and just nod and not say anything. And might wait for a couple of days to see if she says anything. Then I'll be authorized after 4 days of no mention. Hey, wait a minute. Did you listen to it? And what's she going to think of it, you know? So, anyways, why am I telling you all this? You asked me about interacting with people.
About interacting with people, and you said sometimes you have no social desire. There's no, you know, social desire there to interact with people. And I found that interesting because here I definitely feel that way, but I thought it was because there's just so, you know, New York is so overly crowded. The second you step out, there's nothing but people and cars and just busyness. So your lifestyle is not like that there. And I was comparing the way I live to someone who probably lives somewhere secluded, sort of deep in the woods or something, and they come out to their local store, you know, whenever they need to get anything, and they might be more friendly, more, you know, the desire might be there. So, oh, there's another human. Let me, you know, say hi,
right.
How are you, blah, blah, blah. Talk a little because I thought that's probably one of the only ways you can actually have a social desire is if you don't see many people. But it's interesting
you
feel that way even though where you live is nothing like New York.
Right, and also I do have a very active social life. It's just on the phone.
Yeah.
I'm not isolated. Almost only isolated in the chemical body environment here, but not in my exchanges with the other human beings in the chip body.
Right. And you do it according to your own
schedule.
You know, to your own schedule, exactly, to your own schedule. You do it when you want to do it. It doesn't happen just, you know, spontaneous, you know.
But I can look pretty friendly. I just did it with a new INET. If I see I have a break, I'll call them up and answer their questions and like talk to them for 40 minutes and they're amazed that the great Bob Neverett fucking called them up. They can't believe it, you know, but they don't realize I've got the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a good PR person for this Ionic scene because my situation means that I can engage people one-on-one, so to speak.
Your situation really works out perfectly for you because you go a whole week without, you know, much interaction, and then you let it all out over your 18-hour show.
But that's not true. You have to realize I'm on the phone with someone every day.
Yeah, but that's according to your schedule. You don't see them in person, so there is a difference.
Right. But I prefer to talk to them on the phone because you can do more with thought and speech than looking at somebody or being in a restaurant with the waiters fucking interrupting you all the time. You know, it's irritating with other people around.
Yeah, and I think when you see them in person, you're also likely to pick up resonances or, you know, something from them that you may not want, and then you bring it home with you. So you're a little safer on the phone.
Yeah. Ion has said that I live in too pristine of an environment.
Well, I don't know. Bob's always on in his TV body.
So.
Well, not always on my TV body.
Always. I'll wake up in the morning, come down, and I've said this before, and you'll be in the middle of a show, and I'll get the backlash of it.
Oh, I become whatever show I'm watching. So if it's a violent show, I start acting, talking violently to Carol.
I'll punch you in the face, and that's from my
Yeah, I'll punch you in the face or something. Yeah.
No, no, Bob was very polite about the punch in the face. He said, do you want me to punch you in the face? It wasn't a threat. It was a question.
Yeah, yeah.
<Except Yes. laughs> So, yeah, Bob picks up, and it is good that he's not out in public.
Eventually, I get caught I am not a normal human being,
and then
the fucking anxiety starts in the other people.
No wonder I tip so well.
What's that mean?
In restaurants, because you abuse the waiters so much.
Oh, you tip well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I thought you were quoting me. Yes, that's right, you cover it up. And Carol covers up the embarrassment of me. But is that what you mean, Carol? That eventually I can't be out interacting in public because eventually they start to find out what I'm doing. And then they'll start hearing I'm the greatest person who's ever lived. And then they realize that they start avoiding me.
I don't know about the greatest person. You come across as a corrupt, violent jerk.
Well, not with people I don't know.
Well, the waiter, remember, get away from the table, will you stop pushing that water jug in my face?
Yeah, but that's somebody I never see again.
Bob, that's someone you don't know that you weren't.
I'm talking about if I went to the pool like you and went there every day, there'd be trouble. There would have been trouble 7 years ago. The last time I was there was 2009.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if I start becoming regular, then you got a problem because eventually I'll have to perform it. I'll start talking like I did with that woman. I said, you meditate? You want to hear about the new kind of meditation? You know, call into our radio show. So you get it, Carol? We have to define it precisely. I can be violent to a waiter. I never see him again.
Well, that's no justification.
No, but it's different. In a community, I don't act violent. I wouldn't yell at my neighbor. But eventually, after seeing him for 3 months, then I might start to get a little rambunctious. My humor might get a little extreme, and then he's going to get puzzled. Because I start off as appearing to be a very quiet, shy person. Remember? Those people said, oh yeah, we know about Carol's husband. We hear he doesn't talk much.
Yeah, I'm Muslim.
Yes, I'm not allowed to go down to the pool.
It also explains why I have no friends. I couldn't possibly bring anyone to the house.
That's right. They got to deal with me, and that ain't going to go over well eventually. But it's great.
Unless they know Bob first, and then you become friends with them, and then you can probably bring them home.
You mean they know me before Carolyn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's perfect the way it is. I don't require to interact with people in the chemical body. I've created my lifestyle. It totally works.
Yep, it works for you.
So what did you do? You go to sleep at 3 a.m. and gone for 5 hours?
No, I stay on the phone and for as long as I can. I listen to, for example, last night I was listening to you, Minimax, talk, and around.
That was pretty good. That was a very good conversation. Did you like it?
It was probably the longest one you've had with him, too.
Yes.
Because he usually has to go.
Yeah, but he said it was a good conversation, so he stayed.
Yeah, it was. It was good. Yeah, it's good.
So what's your point, though? So, yes, you listen.
You asked me, yeah, so I go around 2 o'clock, I fall asleep, but I would every now and then wake up and catch glimpses of the conversation, and then I would notice that there's someone new on the phone. And whenever I'm tempted, because I have myself on mute, so when I'm tempted to take myself off mute to add something to the conversation. I wonder how sleepy and groggy I sound, so I don't. And then I just continue to listen.
You get self-conscious about it. So, so yes, your phone would be there. You don't hang up. It's there for many hours.
I don't hang up.
If you go to bed or go unconscious around 2, that would be 8 my time. So at 8 at night, which is just new for me, it's just young, the evening's young, that's when you're going. And then you're not there for 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, you know,
I'll
you're
in
asleep.
And out.
Right, but the reason
then,
why...
And then now, then you wake up 5 hours later, but we're not there anymore, because that's the period where I don't have the show. I take a break.
But usually, like last night, I caught the last few minutes of you talking to Bert, and you said you were going to get off and be on a break for 5 hours. So I knew that, you know, that has been the normal for the past few weeks. So the first time you did that, the first or the second time you went on a break for the 5 hours, I woke up during that break and you were talking to, I think, James Pusty and someone else, Chatterer, Bert or someone. So, it was Bart.
Not James. So, James has not been on for almost a year.
No, James, it was Bart. You were talking to Bart and I think Bert. So you were talking to them and it was a good conversation. So I take myself off mute and I decide to, you know, contribute because it was interesting and fun, but no one was acknowledging what I was saying, and I thought, oh, damn, that bot has me on mute again. So I started.
Oh, you were talking, and you didn't know that we weren't hearing you.
Yeah, you weren't hearing me, so I start in-quicking you, and I start putting up messages, take me off mute, goddamn, take me off mute. Hours later, I realize it's just a recording, and you guys aren't even there.
Oh, okay. That was the first time.
Okay. Yeah, that was like the first or the second time. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's good. So I won't be mad at Bob when I see him.
Right. Yeah. No, I should go look over there now. I mean, when I get talking, I'm all involved with talking, paying attention, and there's all this dialogue going on the chat line, or people are in-quicking me messages.
And you go to other parts of the room and get comfortable in a different chair or couch.
Right.
You don't sit at your little seat.
Yeah, I'm not looking at the computer all the time beside it. So there's all these comments, even you are typing.
How many hours of sleep do you get, Connie?
I do 5 or 6 hours. But then I'll have a nap during the day, so I love my naps. But
I love my daytime nap.
Yeah, but my night sleep, you know, I used to be fanatic about needing my 8 hours. You know, I'd stop a recording with Ion so I could go to bed. Bob's yelled at all over all the sessions we did on what, Bob, Revelation? Because I always leave ahead of time because I had to go to bed.
Yeah.
So
that's so funny because I used to think I must get my 9 hours of sleep, and if I don't, I won't be like in a good mood, or I'll be groggy, or I'll be tired. But that all went out the window when I heard Bob, you know, only gets a few hours of sleep and he's still functioning. So a lot of things just, you know, you drop them.
Yep. So
anybody there, Bob?
Nobody's there. I should ask Bill if he's awake.
And I'm jumping in the shower.
See if who's listening on the computer.
Okay, and Ian is probably not going to come on today, right?
Well, when he comes late, he comes around 7:30, so he could still show up in the next half hour.
Okay.
Lately, he would come late.
Yeah.
So, you know, I should play the video of me and Roxy talking, the last one we did the other day, because Ginny said it was good. I'd like to hear what it is, so I think I'll play that. We've run out of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I got to go too, but I'll have my phone on and I'll keep myself on mute.
Yeah, I think I'll play the latest thing, so I can get to hear what's said and keep up with it. So, okay, well, nice talking to you.
Same here.
Wonderful talking to you.
Wonderful.
All right? Yeah, wonderful.
Right.
Okay, keep snipping away at me. Keep attacking me.
As long as
in the chat line. A different personality on the chat line. You have.
Yeah, everyone has a different personality. And, you know, even Donald Trump, he, at home, he loves Hillary Clinton, but out in public, masked man, he's like, you know, the hell with her. She's evil, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so do you have any suitors who you're saying, well, I can't see you Saturday night? You still doing that?
well, most people who know me, like family and friends, they know I don't go out Saturday nights, but nothing else new on the horizon.
Right. You haven't had a nuisance bothering you about that?
Nope. Mm-mm.
All right. Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Talk to you later, Bob.
Yep. Now I got to find this recording. Oh, there's Bill. I got disconnected for some reason. Did Bill answer the question? Stats. Yes, there it is. That's a good number. There's the number. I'm not going to say what it is, but it's not bad. Okay, we got to go. Bring up the recent dialogue. Where is it? Vimeo.
Yes. Yeah. Executive produced by Lorenzo. Great name. Lorenzo. What? Lorenzo, it's a great name.
Yeah, it has ra and it has sar.
A garble.
Yes. I was really amazed looking at the ceiling, thinking on how to understand the apocalypse. You have to understand McLuhan, because I was reading a journalist called Pierre Jovanovich. He wrote a lot about the economy, and during the fall of 2008, when there was the record fall, and the index went to 777, and the bell rang when you saw 7777. So he was trying to compare that to the apocalypse, and he went to read the Bible, and he was very impressed to see that there was all these seven symbolism in the Bible, and that he went to see patterns, like the type of patterns Ion is talking about, how the banks are the churches. And he says the apocalypse is actually the crash of banking and media. And to understand this real apocalypse, I think only you can explain, because you have been exploring this environment for a long time, but it's interesting that other persons that are completely out of Iondom, really serious journalists, are seeing these patterns. And you've been doing this, putting the audience eye on, not on, like McLuhan.
Yeah.
Talking about these weird patterns and connections of the vortex of the environments we are flooded with. And, yes, I would like to also get your completion on this idea that McLuhan said the evolution of the brain stopped even before fire and clothing and all the other technologies.
The survival cannot be trusted to natural response or natural instinct, since the brain stem is not provided with any means of responding to man-made environments. Our diencephalon, our huge evolutionary structure of nerves and brainstem, evolved over long periods of time, was finished, ended its development long before the first technology.
So with the fall, our evolution sort of stopped, but with your products you activate again this evolution of the brain and the mutation of the blood. And but to understand it, really, I get how you need McLuhan.
Yeah.
Who I think got it and had this complete view of the environment as the art form. And that's why he was Catholic, because he was seeing what we are perceiving them.
Yeah. All right, so you can hear me, right? I put my sound down, but it still comes through. Okay, so there's several insights into apocalypse. In my own experience, when I met the Cosmic Awareness Group around David Worster in late 60s, he pointed out that Rai, the original separateness that created this world, it's almost a Gnostic mythology, but this world was created by this phenomenon of Rai. And then Rai returned to the plane of essence in January 67, and therefore the separateness between earth and heaven was no more, to use Bible terms. So that was the first time I heard of an ending, a completion. So I thought about that for a few years, and then when I started to grasp more of what McLuhan was saying in the early 70s, he was the next guy to talk about apocalypse in my experience. And Take Today, the book that came out in 1972, was really important for how it expressed the apocalypse, the total revelation, the total completion of media, epitomized by Finnegan's Wake, and some of the ideas that he has at the end of the book in Take Today. So that was my media mirror for what Rai had done in 67. Then I met the Evergreens, and they first defined the Second Coming as a time of perpetual change. And then they said that the real Armageddon would happen in 500 years. That was the Armageddon, not the same thing as apocalypse. It would happen in 500 years when people will have developed technology to such a level that they will know that if they implement the next new technology, it'll erase everything anybody ever knew. And humanity will vote on it, or there will be a choice by some committee or something, a decision whether to implement the technology, knowing that we'll forget everything we ever knew, be that kind of Armageddon, and whether to do that or not. So that was the next interpretation of Apocalypse and Armageddon, the Evergreens. Let me see if there was another point. Okay, I'll just say that. So then the next thing is the fourth information on the Armageddon and the apocalypse is Ion. And Ion had a way more complex statement of what it all was. Ion was always saying that the apocalypse, the Armageddon, had already happened. But they did say that the four horsemen of the apocalypse rode out every day. They appear in this world every day to act out some kind of a four levels of apocalypse. So that was interesting that that was going on. But then I would get into more subtle ideas of how everything had already happened. And for most people, they were subject to that. But the ascended person was not in time. and therefore would not be subject to Armageddon or apocalypse. They might be subject to a personal apocalypse on the way to getting to the ascended state of no time. But that was, and Ayn has a lot of other variation on this. He lays it out satirically, he lays it out humorously, he lays it out seriously. And it was a big surprise to be told that I was the cause of the apocalypse. So that was rather ridiculous, you know. And the Armageddon. Uh-oh, here she's getting her phone. This is worth talking about.
Yes, because
Luis, no, a little louder.
Luis also was talking about the angels in Hollywood, and for example, this journalist Pierre Jovanovich.
Yes.
He sees that the banking that Ayn calls the churches,
yes,
needed the evolution of media and computing to evolve, to establish, and then the process of the apocalypse is part of this crashing of the banking and all medias.
Right.
He said he went to study the evolution of computers, and he was very surprised to see that the Apple, the first model was called 777, the price was 666, and the yeah, logo is the Apple, the beaten Apple,
yeah,
the fall. And then Ayn comes and says the completion is to create a new cloud, and
a new what?
A new cloud.
A new cloud, yes. Yeah.
And we see all these metaphors in the Bible, but how they present also the example of Trump being like the trumpet of the apocalypse.
Yes. Yes.
It's all happening in a way that really corresponds to what Johann the Revelator was written about.
Yes, John the Revelator.
John the Revelator. Johann.
Did you say Johann?
Yes.
Johann,
like,
that be John?
Be in Deutsch.
Deutsch. Yes, you have many, you go to France, have many languages coming through you.
Yeah, tut mir leid. But, yes, okay. Marshall McLuhan, he was Catholic, and he always said, I hope we will find a solution to this situation. And you studied all this media ecology and actually developed the product.
The solution.
The solution.
I came up with the solution.
Yes.
Yes. Now, so I went through the four phases of the apocalypse / Armageddon, and then Ayn said that, Bob, you're going to actually come up with a solution, you and Carolyn and JW. So we proceeded to do that. And you take some of these products, and you can see how the taste changes. You can see how the white stuff grows in it. There's been definite living alchemical changes in the product that Ayn gave us. So it's special. It's having stronger effects on people. So I'm in the position of not worrying like the previous people. I don't know if McLuhan worried. He seemed to worry sometimes. Prayed a lot, supposedly. But I don't have to do that. Okay, so let me see. Do we go back and explain the history of media? I'm stating that I'm in a position of transcendence in relation to this history. I'm not involved in time. I'm not involved in worrying about the Armageddon or the apocalypse. It's not going to happen to me. And I'm in a curious position where I trigger all kinds of bad things if I'm not cool. Now, I personally don't believe that. But Ayn keeps saying that. And, you know, if he wants to describe me as that kind of alchemical agent, yeah, go ahead. Good for the ratings. Good for the satire of the radio show. But
yes,
I'm not going around.
You have to do this looking back to understand how the environment is the message, how the environment is the art form and you can program it and to understand how you were going to be the solution.
Right. So let me go back. So the real change was the printing press. And in normal secular history, it's a crowning point in human history because that's when knowledge doubled, quadrupled, and humans really started to get something going compared to the medieval time and previous times. Now, Ayn says that the development towards the computer has happened several times, six times or so. And you can see, and I write about this in my essay in 1995 and Up the Orphic Ante, that you can see the history of media from speech up to the computer. That cycle is inevitable because you're extending the parts of your body, so all the parts unfold naturally. And that was the process that James Joyce saw and put in Finnegan's Wake. And then McLuhan understood and saw that in Finnegan's Wake. And especially living in the time of television and satellites and computers, he could see the completion that was coming with the technology. So if the mind takes over, you will inevitably produce hardware machines, and then electric machines, and then digital machines, and you'll come to this point where the whole world is experiencing and living in 24/7 in the same global membrane and looking at the same information if it wants to. We have the extra twist of Web 2.0 where you don't have to look at the standardized content of the global membrane. You can look anywhere else. So there's a lot of fragmentation going on. We just had a little earthquake here, right here in Maui, a little shake-up, a little vibration. So I write about this inevitable development of technologies. So this would be why Nostradamus, John the Revelator, and any other buddy who was a prophet. If you look at how media are the extension of the body parts, you can see the inevitable, almost robotic, predetermined evolution of the technologies from different body parts. You have the extension of the mouth, then the extension of the eye, then the extension of the muscles, then the extension of the central nervous system, and then the extension of the planet with the satellite, and then the shrinking of it all by the digital. So if one knows that, if you taught that, I guess you could say it was always there to be understood, but most people couldn't read, they couldn't find out the information. It was only the lonely scholars, monks, or Jesus that found out this pattern, but you could go to some mystical school and they probably knew this effect. The Dalai Lama and his buddies, the Tibetans probably know this or knew it. So it's interesting why McLuhan calls it from cliche to archetype. The inevitable evolution of technology is a cliche process, and each phase becomes archetypal as you move into the new cliche probe. So now we have this incredible cliche probe of the Android me, which is Armageddon, images of Armageddon, and Apocalypse, Revelation, constantly 24/7. Now, Joyce presents in The Finnegan's Wake the 10 thunders, and each thunder is a new technological development. And each new technological development, like speech or writing, and then chariots or gunpowder or cannonballs, manuscripts, all these various media that were unfolding over the last, say, 8,000 years, each one upset the society and the world that they entered in. That's why, you know, a lot of emperors back then, they would kill anybody who brought in new technology. They kind of knew, hey, you're going to upset everything, cause a problem for my empire. You're going to disrupt it. So they saw that each technology was going to bring in an Armageddon for that on the level of the society, and cause a revelation of things that people couldn't take. So you see that pattern in Finnegan's Wake repeated. Each thunder, the same old pattern of the phoenix coming back, phoenix rising up, Armageddon battles, apocalyptic battles, and he does it all the way through the book. So in some ways the book is just like 10 themes, 10 sound bites repeated all the way through the book. But he's trying to show there is a progression to it, an underlying breakthrough in the end. And so Ayn says that I set it up that we would fall, go through this process of technological entrancement, and then get ourselves out of it at the last minute, like a good Hollywood movie. You know, the hero comes in and saves the day. Well, the way we saved it this time Don't know if we saved it before, but Ayn has said we have done this process with Ayn 6 times or so before, just like in the Matrix movie. He's about 6 or 7 times. I think it's the 6th time he's coming through, the architect tells Neo. The punchline is to go back to the original alchemy, the original solution, which was to evoke non-physical to be a dialoguing, contributing assistant to anything you want to do. And that's what I accidentally triggered. On a little man level, I triggered it accidentally, but now we're here working with it, and we're fully conscious of what we're doing and having a great time. And we are much like Donald Trump. In that article, he's projecting this image that people are so fearful of, and he is just going along like a drunk maniac, having a great time himself, eating lots of ice cream, and going 24/7, speaking, getting interviewed, as long as it's about him. It's all about him. That's the kind of this movement about him, the ultimate narcissist. And apparently, I've been doing that for a few years myself, before Trump showed up. So I am anticipating the Trump effect. So we could say he's even preparing the ground for me. He's like John the Baptist. He will loosen people up to a kind of slack-filled, narcissistic guy. And by the time he's finished for 4 years, the world will be quite used to that. And I'm going to have to come up with something different. So that I can tease, bug, probe. You know, the manipulative presidency. That's what's coming. The manipulative presidency. Trump's doing pretty good at it, but it's just laying the groundwork. So, now, that's where the idea of the Akashic Records comes in, that all inventions are locked away somewheres, and man, different male, female geniuses tap into the Akashic Records, which has all the technologies, and they draw down one of them. You know, they invent the cannonball or something. And all these inventions are in the box known as the Akashic Records, or zone. Now, that's a mystical thing, and Ion doesn't like referring to the idea of the Akashic Records, because he says there's something off there hidden that you don't have access to. What McLuhan does is he replays the Akashic Records and gets rid of that concept, because you have the logic of you're just going to extend your senses. And once you know that you're extending your senses and each one's going to be extended, it's not a problem to understand the evolution of technology. It makes total sense. It's going to stimulate the body so that in the end you're going to end up with a double of Roxana, a clone looking just like you, and it's going to be a product of all this computerized genetics that will make a double of you. So in the end you're looking at yourself when the double walks in your room here, and it's been created by technology, by fallen men, by little men, and you look at yourself. That's the ultimate mirror, and it can do things for you. And then you will have to confront the fact that it's only you that all technology is. So then you have to confront the fact you're alone, or appear to be alone, or you just made everything fit you, and it was just a projection of you. Like they talk about, hey, you're projecting. You're projecting this, that, me, you're projecting that notion, that attitude, that emotion. Well, when you get your clone comes into your room and looks at you, that's a projection that you've made. So we're going to enhance the meaning of projection.
Yes, I always wonder why the symmetry, perfect symmetry, was so important since Egypt.
Okay, I'll explain that.
And it was also this mirroring, this perfect mirroring, the symmetry.
You know what that is? That's a good point. That is the stubbornness of the human soul, the human ego, the human fear of death. The stubbornness to cling to a constant form. So sacred geometry is a trompe-l'oeil, because people are enraptured with the symmetry of the Fibonacci circle and the repeating pattern. Does that mean, oh, there's order in the universe?
The divine proportions, the polygons.
yeah, the divine polygons. And the problem is, it reflects the human's requirement to keep its labyrinth of its mind continuing. It doesn't want to give up its mind. It doesn't want to enter into a chaos. So all of sacred geometry, or the Fibonacci circle, or the symmetry in Egyptian art, is a reinforcement of the little man's fetish about keeping form continuous. And actually, to ascend, you have to drop your form. You have to drop your desire for continuity. Another word for that is, be not afraid of death. But I'm saying that all culture is a reflection of the vanity of the human looking in the mirror. And in the end, he gets to have a human being simulation of you shows up and looks at you and confronts you. Now, Ian has told me this. You know this joke. When I meet my double. Now, there is Ian says there are many doubles of us. So the mistake of little men here in this world is that we think we have to make a technological double of ourselves when there's already many doubles in other worlds and other dimensions. And if you knew about that, you wouldn't get trapped in the technological enterprise. So one can really look at the technological enterprise as a huge, huge, silly enterprise that actually causes a lot of problems for yourself. Now, I can't deny we've had a lot of fun over the last 150 years with the great music and the great recordings and the great feast of media and entertainment.
The orgy of communication.
What?
The orgy of communication.
Yeah, the orgy and ecstasy of communication. It's been fantastic. So I'm glad we went the fall away. And I actually promoted it 10,000 years ago. And I said, we're going to fall. We're going to fuck up. But it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a great journey. And we'll put the ascension off as much as possible. Keep moving it down the road so we never get there. Well, we did that for 10,000 years. And then I guess I'd had enough and we were ready to end the process. And so, of course, as soon as I decided to end this 30, 40 years ago, all the abundance pours on humans. They never imagined 30, 40 years ago, the abundance of ecstasy of communication, making and receiving product and imageries that we have today. None of the, Orwell didn't see that. Huxley didn't see it in Brave New World. Nobody saw it except Finnegan's Wake. Now, Finnegan's Wake was not seen when it was produced, and it was so confusing, nobody knew what it was projecting. But you can look back now that Finnegan's Wake was the best science fiction. It does show the information overload. And that's how, and the information making. It's not just overload, it's the fact that you can make your own media dynamics, your own media spaces. Therefore, you don't need to listen to someone else tell you something. You create your own information fantasy or projection. That is why banking and media come to an end, that your French thinker has posited, has presented this idea. Because the reason 2008 happened was that the banks couldn't communicate anymore. They couldn't get on the same page. Just too much decentralization of crazy notions of how to make money to keep the symbolic exchange going. So the media and the banking together reached a completion point where the decentralization of the audience could not be controlled, so everybody was allowed to be technologically on their own, and nobody could have to be on the same page. And we're now at that point, and nobody knows how to reunify the situation, how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, the cracked up, decentralized communication environment. So people can't even find a place that they can agree on to put their treasures, their personal property, how to save it, how to preserve it. And the banks aren't trustworthy, so there's no social... There's no social bond anymore. And that's an Armageddon. That'll lead to a lot of people killing and shooting and attacking other people. They'll be in a rage because there's nothing to make them feel that they're obligated to you, to your social well-being. So, you want to say something?
Well, only that his theory is that with the Android meme, the only way to control was through banking. Like the churches, which are the banks, really know a lot about you by how you consume, spend your money.
Okay,
and they can also erase your account or control you with... that was like the last way to control the population, but it failed, like you said.
All right. And I'll show you how McLuhan fits that in. You know, writing, and especially the phonetic alphabet, and then the printing press was the extension of the eye. And the eye is the only medium that can have detachment from the other senses. So it can, like, sit on the sidelines. So when banking came in 500 years ago with the printing press and currencies and gold and credit, the bankers, McLuhan said, and Gutenberg Gauss, were able to conspire. They were able to play off one culture, one nation with another, because they had the central switchboard, which was sort of off the planet. It was in this Ivory Tower visual space, the effect of the printing press. So they were able to manipulate, they were like a little spaceship going around the planet, and from that detached visual space perspective and structure to manipulate all the other technologies and all the other senses. So they had that detached position until you get to the 20th century. And when radio came in, it was so world-swallowing. It absorbed everybody into this simultaneous broadcasting mechanism. And visual space didn't have a position off planet. It was swallowed up in the radio environment. So visual space collapsed in 1929. The organizing as a ground by money was superseded by the new ground of radio information and movies and telephones. So the collapse of the visual space happened in the 1920s. So then there's been an interesting rebuilding of the banking visual space since then, a simulation of it. Eventually, they had to make money. They had to keep money going to keep some semblance of visual space. And they said everybody has access to money. They called the welfare state or guaranteed unemployment insurance if you lost that. So money became the people's property. And that kept money going for, you know, 50 years. And then the digital environment, which is the Android me, which replays the history of media, it replays the apocalypse that happened, you could say, in World War II, or the apocalypse of the 50s, the Cold War. But anyways, the Android me is going to replay that in many ways. And it collapsed the public sharing of money, the public possession of money. So then you had no money, and cash wasn't, paper cash was not viable. McLuhan says, and I said in media, that there's been civil war among all the media environments, all the electric technologies, all the historical media, except for the printing press, which sits on the sidelines, he says. That's the bankers, sitting on the sideline. So the banker had a crisis in the late 20s, when the first electric simultaneity swallowed it. They weren't able to get outside of the tribal drum. So they had to adjust it, and they basically gave up the function of banking, said, okay, the banks are yours. Money is public property. And then after World War II, they said, you get credit. Everybody gets credit. That was a revolutionary idea. And then you had the consumer's paradise. But then, unwittingly, the technologies that people were consuming flipped into electronic digital software and became a tactile interplay where you are able to make your own media and make your own entertainment. So that removes the bankers finally. The bankers do not have an ivory tower satellite platform of going around the media and manipulating from off planet or from the sidelines. So the collapse of that, you can see various collapses in 1929, you could even maybe say 39 with the beginning of World War II, then in the late 50s in the United States, and then late 60s in London, late 70s globally. Then you had the junk bond world in the 80s, and then the tax derivatives, and then the virtual economy, and that collapses in the early 90s. And then what did they do? Then they brought in the dot-coms, where kids or anybody could make up a business plan, and you gave away money to virtual space. So that was the last gasp, and that ended in 2000. So then there was only one more fearful icon to bring in, and that was to knock out the technologies that controlled the world banking. That was the Twin Towers. The Twin Towers was where all transactions went through up till 93 when the Twin Tower was bombed in February 93. After that, the monitoring of all credit financial transactions moved to Malaysia, and that was when China was reasserting its power, and it made sure that the Maybank in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, became the new monitoring of every credit thing that you will ever do, or me or anybody will do, that was the operation at the World Trade Center up to 93. Now it moved to Kuala Lumpur, and you have that from 93, 94 till 2008. And now you have every icon of wealth floundering about trying to determine what is real, what is the economy. And the only thing that's keeping it going is that people still show up and keep talking. engaging in the ecstasy of communication is the only, that is the real currency. And of course, that's going to cause a lot of identity crisis in people, and a lot of quadriphenia, because nobody knows really, their old reference points aren't there anymore. Not even the eternal death and taxes aren't there anymore. And then that led, that was the opening for the original alchemy, the original medium, the original technology, the original money, the original currency, the original slack to show up, known as ion. And therefore, we retrieve the original alchemy, which you're witnessing right here. You have a front row seat every week to talk to the Antichrist and the Anti-Bob and the Anti-Jack and the Anti-Susan and the Anti-this and the Anti-that, uncle, all the way, with a little aunt thrown in, a little Anti-aunt, all that happening constantly here.